From Michigan Radio, this is Stateside. I'm Lester Graham in for Cynthia Canty. The Tigers season is over, and John U. Bacon is pretty sure the Lions season is over, too.
I'm going to say it now. I've got no faith in this team. Jim Caldwell, very nice guy by all accounts. But look, at Wake Forest, 8 seasons, he had 1 winning season.
Then teaching young men of color about how to run a business.
Young black men have tons of really great ideas, but have no idea how to execute.
A discussion about domestic violence and what to look for.
Assailants use the violence as a means of control.
And just how did Mike Vile record his new album that's released today?
And I just did 150 takes. We picked the best 10, and then the record was done.
We'll hear some of that new music. But before we do all that, let's find out what else is going on in the world. Welcome to Stateside. I'm Lester Graham and for Cynthia Canty. Coming up a little later, political yard signs. They don't win elections, but candidates love them anyway.
Literally, candidates want to see their name in lights. We have these huge electronic billboards that go up on the freeways. These are almost like the kind of thing you see in Vegas.
Why campaign signs might be going the way of nickel beer and the rotary phone. Also, it's getting to be that time of year to put away the lawn tools, the mower, the trimmer, the goats. But first.
The best and the brightest.
Opportunities. The next idea.
We're going to find that these social and cultural factors really add a lot to economic growth.
The Skillman Foundation has awarded $50,000 each to 6 different programs in connection with the My Brother's Keeper Detroit Innovation Challenge. One of the 6 was giving them the business. And that's the subject of this week's The Next Idea. The goal is to teach young men of color to be owners and operators of restaurants, not just the hired help, according to a release from the foundation. Joining us to talk about this is Jarrell Harris. First, the release included a quote which indicated, "Young black men face unique disparities that prevent too many from reaching their full potential." What are some of the barriers that young black men and other people of color face?
I think one of the primary barriers is lack of access to information. There are too many instances where young black men have tons of really great ideas but have no idea how to execute on those. We have a very fragmented education system. These young men are graduating, if they graduate at all, very underprepared to enter the workforce and to be a part of the new economy. So that is probably one of the most significant barriers that they face, lack of information and just lack of preparation for business ownership.
How does this project, giving them the business, help them overcome some of those barriers?
What it does is it puts these young men in a real-world experience where they're actually learning how to be owners and operators of a restaurant while they work in the business. We often tell people, oh, go write a business plan and come back with your idea, but if you've never been exposed to what it really means to own or operate a business, then your business plan is really pointless. It's really just a made-up document that isn't really based on fact. And so this program gives these young men the opportunity to really get their hands into the business of operating a restaurant. So they learn skills from accounting to financial management, inventory and scheduling and food costs, all the things that go into actually being an owner that they typically would not learn if they were just employees in the business.
I understand in the past the project was basically held in a classroom and that didn't work all that well. What was wrong about that and what are you doing now?
Really, it was boring. That was the number one problem. The guys did not find it interesting. They did not want to sit and be lectured to all day. They thought that the format of, you know, the traditional classroom style just was not the best way to teach this type of information. So we completely scrapped the original plan and put them in a food truck environment. You know, I have a good friend who operates a food truck here in Detroit. And once the guys were able to see hands-on what it meant to run a business using the food truck as a classroom, it completely changed the way they thought about the information that we were teaching. And so, for example, teaching food costs is one thing to sit in a classroom and have an Excel spreadsheet and punch in a bunch of numbers about what things cost. But when you actually go to the restaurant depot to buy your supplies and you sit down and create your menu and you look at what costs go into creating the food that you're selling, you actually see that food get produced. You have a much different understanding of what it takes to create and to cost out things. So we really had to revamp how we were teaching the different principles and really get hands-on with the guys, and that completely changed the way they related to the information.
How do you choose who can attend this training?
So we started with just reaching out to my network. I worked for a nonprofit when I first started here in Detroit, so I had a number of different contacts in the space. I cast the net and said, look, I'm looking for young men between the ages of 16 and 24 who are interested in business. It may not even be the restaurant business, but they're interested in having their own business. They're not looking for a traditional college program or traditional business training program. They really want to do something a little bit different that's hands-on. Send them my way. And so I got six really great referrals, six really great young men who participated in the program. And now they have friends who are, you know, looking to get in. So hopefully we'll be able to get up and running and expand the program to open it up to a lot more young men.
How long do they train?
So over the summer, we did a pilot that was only for 6 weeks. But the full-scale program will probably be about a nine-month training program.
Now, do you help place these young men or help them find ways to start their own business after they complete this training?
So, yeah, so part of the program, the goal really, the way we measure success is going to be either, one, how many of the young men actually start their own business after going through the program, or how many of them find employment as maybe managers or upper-level staff at a restaurant or some type of hospitality business. We also are going to be working with them to help identify funding opportunities because that is another major barrier to opening a restaurant or any small business is how do you get funding. So that is also a major piece of the curriculum that they go over. And so we'll be helping them every step of the way from identifying what type of business they want to go into, which may or may not be a restaurant. You know, the skills that they're learning hopefully are transferable to a number of different business ventures, and then helping them identify locations to where they can open, and then as well as identifying funding to get their business up and running.
Is this a one-off type of project, or will there be more in the future?
There'll hopefully be more in the future. I think that there's definitely a demand for this type of planning and this type of project. So hopefully this first round goes very well and we're able to expand it across the city and open up a lot more restaurants that service training centers for young men, and we'll see a lot more things come out of it.
Jarrell Harris is coordinating the project, Giving Them the Business, which is one of six projects recently funded by the Skillman Foundation, working with the city of Detroit and the private sector. Hey, thanks for talking with us.
Thank you.
Support for the Next Idea on Stateside comes from Michigan Economic Development Corporation, committed to marketing Michigan to drive job growth and investment in our communities. MichiganBusiness.org.
You're listening to Stateside. I'm Lester Graham in for Cynthia Canty. It's time to check in with Michigan Radio sports commentator John U. Bacon. For Tigers fans, the baseball season is over. There won't even be that makeup day for the rained-out game last week. John, the Tigers ended the season with a 1-0 loss to the Atlanta Braves and ended the chance for a wild-card playoff spot. Why do you think the Tigers were so inconsistent this year?
Due to inconsistency. How's that, Lester, for a rotten answer? Relief pitching. That's the answer. These guys go through seven innings. They've got a lead. They must have blown 10 to 20 easily games along the way. Pathetic performance by their relief pitching. That's the problem.
Will Detroit Tigers manager Brad Ausmus be back for a fourth season?
I'm guessing no. We're going to find out very soon, I think. But we'll see. I think he's got a lot of support in the locker room. That counts for a lot. It's very difficult in baseball, Lester, to tell exactly what the manager does, to be honest. You only make about three or four decisions a day versus a football coach who makes one every single play. So it's difficult to see the influence he's got on his players, but it must be said, under the salty old dog, Jim Leyland, almost every player on his team in Miami, in Pittsburgh, and in Detroit had the best seasons of his career playing for Leyland. The opposite is happening under Ausmus.
Let's talk about money. The Tigers have the third highest payroll in baseball, so it's not really about the owner, Mike Ilitch, not opening up the wallet. So what do you think needs to happen to get this team into the playoffs?
It needs to have relief pitching. They paid for that, though. So again, you're down to the intangibles of why are these guys not performing the way they're advertised. And that might be managing.
Some people are calling the Lions' 17-14 loss to the Bears the worst loss of Jim Caldwell's time as Detroit's head coach. What does that loss and the last-minute loss to Tennessee the week before say about the rest of the season?
It's shot.
Really?
I'm going to say it now. I've got no faith in this team. Jim Caldwell, very nice guy by all accounts. But look, at Wake Forest, eight seasons, he had one winning season. In Indianapolis, his first year taking over for Tony Dungy, they were 14-2. That's great. 2 years later, they're 2-14. That is not great. Look, Caldwell is simply not a very good coach.
Michigan got its first win against a top 10 team since 2008 with a win over the Wisconsin Badgers. What's working for the Wolverines this year?
Defense, defense, defense. That defense might be the best in the nation right now. The offense is good to very
right.
good occasionally, sometimes so-so.
Kicking's a big problem.
We'll kicking is not so-so.
I mean, Michigan missed three field goals on Saturday. So, but back to that original question. What's happening here that hasn't happened in the past?
Defense is the answer, and Don Brown is the defensive coordinator. Harbaugh cannot give him enough credit in postgame interviews. They've got arguably the best defense in the nation right now. That will get you in every single game you play all season long. So right now they become a candidate for a playoff spot. Ohio State is still, without question, the class of the Big Ten, but Michigan is getting close.
The Spartans are now 0-2 in the Big Ten, and they haven't even faced the Big Ten powerhouses, Michigan and Ohio State. How can they salvage the season?
Very easily, and I think D'Antonio will. It's not going to be a great year, obviously. You're 2-2 already. But I think they're going to be a competitive team, and anybody in Ann Arbor who takes them for granted is going to pay a price. So D'Antonio will get them to about 8-4, I believe, before they're done, and they'll be competitive again next year.
Western Michigan, tell me about that team.
How about that team, by the way? They are now getting some national news, actually.
Sure, they ranked 25th.
They ranked 25th, which for any MAC team, of course, is a big deal. Big game, of course, versus Central over the weekend. P.J. Fleck, if you're a Western Michigan fan, enjoy him while you can. He's going to be coaching somewhere else next year because he's too good.
And finally, Eastern, 4-1 on the season. You and I have had some conversations about Eastern's long-running losing record and the amount of tuition money consumed by the football program. Does a winning season make a difference?
It does make a
difference. Are we going to be eating crow? Yeah.
I'm eating crow today. Officially, by the way, my bib is on. I'm eating crow. 4-1 is the best start in forever, pretty much. And Coach Creighton and, of course, Heather Leick, the AD, we have both debated the cost of the program for Eastern Michigan as well as the interest in it from fans and alumni and students, also winning. Now, this solves one of those three problems. They're 4-1. Creighton is doing a fantastic job. My bib is on. The crow is being eaten.
That's Michigan Radio sports commentator John U. Bacon. Thanks for coming in.
Thank you, Lester.
You're listening to Stateside from Michigan Radio. I'm Lester Graham, sitting in for Cynthia Canty. Well, it's fall now. Time to put away the lawnmowers, the weed whackers, and the goats. Father-son duo Mike and Doug Maurer of Twin Willow Ranch have been working their way around southeast Michigan with goats in tow this summer. They call their service all-natural brush clearing, and this backyard in Milford is the goats' last job for the season. Stateside's Lindsay Scullin brings us this audio postcard.
Yes, they have names. We don't know them.
My wife Denise, she names all the goats. She could tell you every goat's name, and she could tell you whose kid, who was their mother and
grandmother for most of them.
Right. She knows everything about them.
I know some of their names. That's Candy's Kiss, and that's Goofy behind it.
That's about it.
Mom calls me Goat Boy. She calls him Goat Man. 32, so I feel like she'd be equal goat man, but whatever. There's only a few ways to clear certain areas of ground where you can't get bulldozers and stuff like that in, or just tractors in. Just the ground's not suitable for it. People don't want to use chemicals because it's bad for the ground and stuff, and they don't want to use burning. It's just unsafe. So the goats come in and do their job, and that's why they use them.
We have 10 goats on this job. All the jobs are set up so that we know how much we need to fence in to keep them in there for a week and let them eat.
It's not like we want them to come in and eat just poison ivy or just poison oak or something like that. They're not missiles. You can't just train them on one thing and have them go. They're just going to eat pretty much everything that's in there. And then the owners can come in and actually get to the base of a tree or get a lawnmower in or get some kind of machinery in. It goes from being this wall of green to where it's just stems and sticks left, and then you can get in there and do your job, whatever you wanted to do, without having to fight through a jungle. And then, unlike birds and other things, when they eat the seeds, they don't spread them because they grind them up, and then they have, was it four stomachs? So then when they go to the bathroom, there's nothing left. It's not like you're spreading more seeds other places.
It's an enjoyment factor for people because they use it for an entertainment. We've had people that have had big parties to come over and watch the goats clear their land and stuff, you know, barbecues and things like that. So it's also enjoyment for them.
And then also with, you know, the big green push nowadays, you know, everybody wants to be, you know, conscious of that, and it's a very earth-friendly method. So the goats come in, the only thing they leave is hoof prints and
fertilizer. That's right.
We tell people they fertilize as they go.
Come on. Good girl.
You can find Mike Maurer, Doug Bauer, and their goats on Twitter and Facebook at Twin Willow Ranch. For photos and video of the goats at work, head to MichiganRadio.org. It's not often you hear of an aspiring musician being encouraged to give up the day job, you know, the one that pays the bills, and plunge headfirst into a musical career. But Ann Arbor-based singer-songwriter Mike Vile got that sort of a wedding gift from his wife, Natalie Berg. She told him she would not marry him unless he quit his job as a teacher to follow his musical dreams. Well, that was 5 years ago. Since then, Mike has played hundreds of gigs across the U.S. and Canada. And now he's out with his fourth release, A World That's Bigger. The musician Mike Vile, he recently spoke with Stateside's Cynthia Canty.
Welcome. Good to have you with us.
Thanks so much for having me.
Talk about a vote of confidence when I think how many other artists have heard the flip side of that coin, like, okay, I'll marry you if you settle down and get that paying job.
Right, right. And it's not an easy decision to make to leave a job to be a full-time artist. And there's no right or wrong answer in paving that way as an artist. I don't think anybody needs to do that choice if it doesn't feel right.
It has to feel right. I know you were teaching English and Language Arts at Holly High School.
South of Flint.
Yeah.
Music. No, I didn't teach music. I like this aspect of the failure. When I was in high school, I tried out at the music programs at colleges across the state. All the rejection letters came on the same day, which was a really good failure as a senior, because I would have been a very shy, like not able to relate to an audience. I would have just been playing guitar. And what teaching has done for me is to meet a lot of great voices. And the classroom has always still been my audience in my mind, because I played for my students at least once a semester. We would read Romeo and Juliet every year. I taught 8 years of freshman English. So Romeo and Juliet was a staple in the curriculum. And before we would read that first monologue, two star-crossed lovers take their life, doth with their death, bear their parents' strife, I would like play a song that I had written about love in college and leaving that person that you first fall in love with. And, you know, the students would relate to those early stories.
So you got to cut your teeth, in a sense, as a performer in front of your students.
I did.
And we know that's a tough crowd.
It is, but it's a great crowd. And people ask me, oh, well, it must have been the students that was hard. And that wasn't why I had to leave the job. I was really exhausted from trying to just keep up with the grading and the planning. 156 students, 5 minutes an essay, you know, like the hours would add up. And I was trying to play some gigs on the side and write songs. And
music is calling you.
It called me.
And I'm curious, what has the freedom to just make music? What has that done to the way you write and record and approach your music? So the day job is gone. No more grading, no more any lesson plans. Focusing on music, what has that done to your music?
At first, it was very freeing, and you had the Sprague family on once talking about their careers as musicians, and when I heard that one, that really related to me, because I would grow up watching them in college play at the bars, and the grind is very difficult. And I've played over 1,000 gigs now, and it's been from everywhere, from the Arc to before Ben Folds Five at Common Grounds Music Festival to that corner bar where no one's paying attention. So writing has actually gotten more difficult in some form, because I'm always worried about the financial aspect as well as the balance with the family now. But that has improved my writing in the sense that I'm getting more, what I would consider more real songs and more real themes that are covering a lot deeper topics. And my writing has improved a lot. So I'm just really happy where I am as a writer, and it's kind of coming through on the strength of the record, if I can say that.
Let's give everybody an idea of what we're talking about, and let's all take a listen to the title track, A World That's Bigger. And this was inspired by the birth of your daughter?
It is.
What was going on in your mind?
It's the first song I wrote as a dad, and she was sleeping in the bouncer at the kitchen. And there's a photo my wife took of me in my robe, and Ginny sleeping there, and she could sleep through the songs. And we live in Dixboro. There's that one-room schoolhouse and a beautiful little church, and I had accidentally looked up how expensive college may cost Ginny if she so chooses that route in 17 years or more. And it was like half the mortgage of the house. So I had to write a song to calm my nerves. And that is a song that really appeared. And it's a song that I wrote from straight to end, you know, with very little editing. The first lines are what became the first verse. And we now walk Ginny down that road or pull her down in the wagon, and we pass that baseball field in the song. And it's my favorite song on the record, and my mom's. She's got a biased opinion, but.
Well, here it is, the title track from his newest release from Mike Vile, A World That's Bigger.
We don't know how big the world will be when we take it slowly down the road to the baseball field by the one-room schoolhouse with the pain that's built and the church won't share. The answers to the secrets in our prayers for you, sing them out, sing them strong, beat our doubts by helping you belong to a world that's bigger than you and me, a world that's bigger for endlessly. The world that's bigger than the length of the sea. The world that's bigger than you and me in love.
Mike, tell us how you recorded this album. This was kind of an interesting, let's get away from it all.
It is. It also was getting away from the fear of having to do a record the way everyone tells you you have to do a record. What I did, my friend Mike Gentry, we were driving out to the Acorn Theater one day for a gig. We had a long drive together, and he just said, Mike, let's just finish your record. We had faced a lot of challenges with the house that was really putting off getting the record done because of the expenses and with a roof problem and leaking water everywhere. So he said, we can get this record done. I know you have it in you. And I just wanted to do the record live, like a classic Nick Drake record. Just me on guitar singing and playing at the same time. We didn't Justin Bieber this record. There's no editing. There's no overdubs. There's some production, but very minor. I mean, it's a very real record like you would picture the Beatles doing at the very beginning of their career. They're all standing around microphones and playing at the same time. So we went to a cabin in northern Michigan, a family cabin, and for 3 days just camped out. And I just did 150 takes. We picked the best 10, and then the record was done. The reason that felt correct is because I've put out quite a few releases, and I've always done it since my first EP with professional and really talented producers, but it was very separate your head from your feet and head from your hands. So like you would do the guitar track, and then you watch the drummer, you'd watch the bass player. Then I'd come in and do like 30 takes of vocals and split it up, and it never was feeling right.
You wanted to feel like if you were standing in front of that audience.
Exactly.
Yeah.
You don't teach that way, and my experience is playing for people. So this record had to get done this way, and it's a very personal record about family, loss, Ginny's birth, following dreams, and miscarriage. So the only way to really do it was live, because I have a high standard for an honest song. So I might have written over 100 songs, but I've only put out 28 because, yeah. You know, it's hard to really believe in them at times, and you got to test them out on the road.
I'm talking with Ann Arbor-based singer-songwriter Mike Vile, out with his fourth release, A World That's Bigger. And I know your uncle is the late State Senator David Plawecki, who served in the Senate from 1970 to 1982. In fact, we should note, he is the one who authored Michigan's Open Meetings Act, which was a huge step towards government transparency. And he died in 2013. Talk about this song, Burning Bright. It's on the album. It's inspired by him.
And just a quick note, it's confusing when you come from a big Polish family because everybody's your cousin and everybody's your uncle. But David is my mom's first cousin, and we grew up down the street from them, all went to Divine Child in Dearborn. I started playing guitar when his son Kirk also started playing guitar, and first bass player in my band, Alan Black, they had found a guitar that the family had I think, played in college in the closet, and we all kind of found music and the Beatles books at David's house. David's dying wish, which was covered in the news, he didn't really want his passing to be about his political service, even though his political service touched a lot of us. He wanted it to be about faith and family. So that surprise gift that he gave to everybody, the secret that he had that his sons had to carry out at the VFW hall. In my Polish family, we eat through our feelings. I definitely do. So we're stacking up the pierogies and the galonkis on the plates to the ceiling and sit down to have dinner at that memorial dinner, and then his sons take the microphone and said, our dad had this surprise, this dying wish, And these envelopes just start getting passed out like it's Christmas, you know? And we open it up and there's $100 he gave to all his friends and family. But that note inside said, I wanted you to be a Christian angel and give that $100 to someone in need. What was amazing for me was it brought the family together during the holidays one more time, because you ended up calling somebody and saying, what'd you do with David's $100? Who'd you give it to? You know, my wife gave it to somebody in need that had somebody died suddenly in the family. And
what'd you do with yours?
I broke it up into two gifts, and somebody that I know really well, his brother got killed, and I gave part of it to them, and then the other $50 I gave away, and I don't really want to say what I did with it, if that's okay. But it was a gift that I wouldn't have been able to give while finances were tough. It was such a gift in multiple ways.
Well, the song is Burning Bright. Let's take a listen.
Life's strange outside, promises tomorrow. It were a thread of gold cut without sorrow. If there's only one star I see up in the sky on a lonely night, think of you burning bright.
Mike, what do you hope your audiences get from hearing your songs?
The teacher in me wants them to know they should be an artist. There's a myth that you can't be an artist, or that it's a special calling for only some. And I don't believe that. I think everybody, when you're a kid, if you ask a child to sing, they all sing, right? Any kid, even my toddler, starting to color with crayons.
And lines don't matter.
They don't. And it doesn't mean we're all going to necessarily make a living from it, but I think art really activates our brains in wonderful ways. I also hope my songwriting will lead people to kind of push beyond the needs for pop music, even though I love pop music. This is a challenging record, and it's a record that was done live. So there's some imperfections, as you hear Ringo miss that beat on the drums on some of those early takes that we enjoyed. I performed really well, if I can pat myself on the back, but there's some flubs in there, which I also hope encourages people to not feel like they have to be perfect.
Well, Mike Vile will be hitting the road for a 10-city tour in October and November to support this fourth release, A World That's Bigger. A couple of the dates include Saturday, October 29th at the Arc in Ann Arbor, and Sunday, October 30th at the Acorn Theater in Three Oaks. You can get the full schedule on the tour by going to MikeVile.com, and that's V-I-A-L, MikeVile.com. So I'm going to ask if you'll take us out with this happy love song. It just made me very, very happy. I just want to be your last. Tell us a little about that song.
It's a song that actually I've been referencing the Beatles, so here we are. I mean, I'm borrowing a songwriting technique where you go from the major four to the minor four in the bridge. Musicians can listen for that on the record. But it's about falling in love with someone a little different than you. The yin and the yang sometimes works out well.
Mike Vile, thank you so much for being with us.
Thanks for having me.
If sugar goes well with coffee, like the day mixes with night, I might be a little different than you, but we go together right. Treat me twice better than I've been treated before. I don't want to sound trite, I just know that I know for sure. We all live with regrets, we shouldn't care about the past. I don't need to be your first love, I just want to be your last. Wanna be your last. You said you had to kiss a few frogs before your prince appeared. Well, I've been waiting for you like the sun waits for clouds to clear. It's been raining for what feels like years. And the whole time you were always near to me, but that's how it goes when we all live with regrets. We shouldn't care about the past. I don't need to be your first love. I just wanna be your last. Your last. 'Cause when I finally found you, I finally forgot my past.
You're listening to Stateside from Michigan Radio. I'm Lester Graham, sitting in for Cynthia Canty. People complain about political ads, robocalls interrupting dinner, mailboxes full of campaign literature. But there's another sign of election season, political yard signs. Candidates love them. Political consultants say they're a waste of time and money. Writer and blogger Chad Selesky of Politically Speaking had a piece in Dome magazine about that, and he joins us now. First, who says political signs aren't worth much in an election campaign?
There have been several studies done by political scientists that show a negligible effect. Behind the scenes, what I've found is that campaign managers, campaign consultants basically hate signs. They end up wrestling with their candidate, their client, over this issue all the time, especially with new candidates. And they think that signs equal votes, and the consultants try to convince them over and over again that there is a better way to spend your money.
I read in your piece that Joe DeSano of DeSano Strategies jokes he'd like to include a clause in clients' contracts that the candidate may not discuss yard sign usage. I take it that this is kind of distracting for candidates and their consultants.
I would say distracting is putting it mildly. I got the impression that some of them get to the point where they're ready to pull their hair out with their own client about signs. And part of it is the candidate likes to see his name everywhere, you know, every intersection. Part of it is supporters want to see those signs all over the place, especially those who contribute to a campaign. I had one candidate tell me that he got a call about midway through his most recent primary campaign, and a guy had donated $500, and he said, kind of sorry I did that because it looks like you're going to lose. And the candidate said, well, why do you think that? He says, because I don't see your signs anywhere, so I think I wasted my money. Well, the candidate did win and won big.
You quoted Leon Drollet, who's a former state rep and a candidate for a seat on the Macomb County Board of Commissioners, as saying, quote, the candidate's biggest opponent is not a name on the ballot, it's the candidate's own ego, end quote. What's he mean by that?
Well, like I was saying, these candidates like to see their name all over the district. It's an ego boost for them. It gives them a feeling that, you know, they're on their way to victory. In Southeast Michigan, it's gotten to the point where literally candidates want to see their name in lights. We have these huge electronic billboards that go up on the freeways. These are almost the kind of thing you see in Vegas, these very flashy lit up billboards. Those in particular, I think, are where the ego problem comes in. You know, the candidate loves to see his name in lights, but someone who's speeding down the freeway maybe could care less.
It did seem from your piece that there are worse signs than others, whether it's billboard or yard signs, and those that simply state Smith for office with a smiling photo of Smith tend to be the worst, while those with a clear message at least have a little more benefit for the campaign. So campaign yard signs, not completely useless. And I guess there's some geography in this as well. Small towns, they might work.
Yeah, in a lot of the suburbs, you see what one consultant I talked to called sign ghettos, which is kind of a clever term because you'll have those key intersections where there are just clusters of signs. In fact, the clusters create a situation where one candidate's sign blocks another candidate's sign, and they're just bunched together in a lot full of weeds, and it's just a bunch of placards with names. More effective way of doing this is to have a message on there, John Smith for lower taxes. You know, something real basic, but that fits in with the message that the candidate is spreading door to door or in literature. As far as geography, what I am told is that in small towns and rural areas, there still is a loyalty factor that the candidate benefits from, even if his sign is just John Smith for state rep. Because if, for example, John Smith's sign shows up in the front window of Joe's Hardware on Main Street, and the folks at Joe's Hardware have a really good reputation in town, everybody likes Joe, and that trickles over to John Smith. He benefits from that, and people say, well, you know, if people at Joe's Hardware like John Smith, he's probably a pretty good guy.
I wanted to ask you, if billboards and yard signs and, as we've been told, robocalls are not really effective ways for candidates to raise awareness of their campaigns, what does work?
Door-to-door. Nothing compares to door-to-door.
So just knocking on doors and talking about the candidate.
Knocking on doors, talking to people, leaving a little placard on the door, a little flyer on the door if the person is not home. That retail politics, that face-to-face campaigning, nothing can beat it. The thing is it's a lot of work, especially, you know, we have these August primaries, and a lot of that door-to-door involves walking in the heat and humidity. It's a very draining process. I've heard countless stories through the years of candidates losing 20, 30 pounds just in the space of a campaign because they're out there. Can be excruciating at times, but that's what you have to do if you want to get yourself elected. And frankly, a lot of candidates are not willing to do it.
I also saw in your article you said that mailings come in a close second, which kind of surprised me because I hear most people talk about the junk mail, but apparently they're looking at them before they throw it away.
Yeah, it's an interesting thing where I hear people constantly complaining about the junk mail that comes in, especially because it comes flooding in at the very end. You know, everybody says, you know, I just toss it in the garbage. But apparently they're taking a peek at it before they toss it in the waste basket because consultants and campaign managers swear by it that you have to get your message out and are not necessarily going to seek out information about a candidate. But if it lands in their mailbox, they might take a minute, maybe 30 seconds to look at it before pitching it. And also, we have an increasing number of absentee voters these days, and a lot of absentee voters just kind of save all that stuff up, put it in a pile, and then when that day comes where they want to sit down at the kitchen table and cast their ballot, a lot of them sort through all of that literature before choosing candidates. They kind of weighing the different candidates back and forth as they look at that literature. So that's also a big impact.
I want to get your thoughts about one more yard sign that I've seen recently. Two of my neighbors have the same political sign. It reads, "Everybody sucks. 2016, the U.S. is doomed." Now, I've seen a lot of people stop, get out of the car, take a photo of those signs. So apparently some political yard signs do get some attention. What do you think of that approach?
Well, obviously, if you have a very unique message on your sign, you're going to get a whole lot more attention. And I would guess that that sign in this particular presidential year reflects how a lot of people think. Everybody always talks about the lesser two evils. I think that's a factor that's in most people's minds this year. And it's going to be interesting to see what will happen with turnout since so many people don't like one candidate or the other or both.
Or any at this point. Chad Selesky writes the blog Politically Speaking. We've been talking to him about his article in Dome magazine that was recently published. Thanks for taking the time.
You're welcome.
A couple of weeks ago in Dearborn Heights, four children were killed and their mother was bound, slashed with a box cutter, and shot in the foot. She alone survived. The man charged with the crime is her husband. That same man murdered his previous wife in 1991. We wanted to talk about the best ways to hold domestic violence assailants accountable and keeping victims or potential victims safe. Joining us now is Barbara Neese May. She's the director of Safe House Center in Washtenaw County. Since this incident in Dearborn Heights, did this come out of nowhere or were authorities notified earlier about the problems? I mean, were there any complaints filed or the police called?
Yes. In this particular case, there were reports that happened, there were notifications that happened and weren't necessarily responded to in a way, obviously, that was going to save the children's lives or keep her from serious harm.
And that's what we want to talk about, how to keep them out of harm. What could have been done to prevent the murder of these children and the torture of their mother?
There's a lot of things that can happen, but often it involves rewinding. I think people want to focus on that day. I mean, they start with at 6 a.m., what happened that day?
This didn't come out of nowhere, and most of them don't, right?
No, absolutely not. Domestic violence is a situation that builds up over time, and the trajectory is different for every single situation. It knows no socioeconomic status, and it can happen to just about anybody. Assailants have what we call learned behavior. Some people think it's rooted in mental illness or drinking or drugging or something like that. But none of that is the case. It's absolutely learned behavior. So it can be unlearned. Depending on who you talk to, it's been years in the making. He clearly learned somewhere along the way that he can have this behavior and won't be held accountable for it.
How common is a situation? I mean, we had four children killed. Obviously, that's not common. But how common is that we have escalation, 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 then violence?
It is very common, Lester. Assailants use the violence as a means of control. For example, jealousy or I love you and so I want to spend more time with you than other people should be able to spend time with you. It kind of starts out with that. And then it starts to build up to I will do this, I will do that. And then they make good on those promises so that they can show I do control you. I am in charge. Violence escalates with the desire for control.
When there's not been an assault, what can police possibly do?
Oh, there's a lot of things that police can do. The legal definition of domestic violence involves the threat or commission of violence. And it is so frequent that there is some sort of threat of violence. A lot of survivors actually aren't even sure. For example, they may be standing and have literally their backs up against the wall. And you can imagine an assailant punching the wall right next to their face. Now, they're not punching the wall. They're punching the wall to tell her the next time it is going to be your face. That is considered a threat of violence. There's also threats of, I'm going to hurt your pet. I'm going to hurt the children. I'm going to take the children away. Those are threats that police need to know about because that's part of things that can go into the report to establish the history of violence.
The question here, she sought a personal protection order from a judge, wasn't able to obtain one. How often does that happen when there are these threats of violence? I'm wondering whether police and courts take domestic violence complaints seriously all over the state or all over the nation, or is it just here and there?
It's actually subjective, quite unfortunately. We do have public policy that dictates how things should happen. However, people who are the arbiters of the criminal system, which could be law enforcement, it can be the prosecutors, it can be defense attorneys, it can be judges, it can be the jail commanders. I mean, just who makes the decisions when and how what they base it on. Unfortunately, for a lot of them, domestic violence is not seen as serious as other crimes because there's a perception of only one victim versus many.
Explain that to me because I'm not following. Why would it just be one victim? I mean, that seems like enough for anybody to be concerned about domestic violence if it's just one, let alone many.
Exactly. And that's the concern that I have, too. Say, for example, there's a jail overcrowding issue. Typically, DV assailants have very good behavior. So there is this automatic, well,
DV, domestic violence.
Yeah, domestic violence. Thank you. There's this automatic reaction of, well, then they should be released first because of the good behavior. And the reality is that they should be the last ones to be released because we know exactly what they're going to do as soon as they're released. They're going to go straight to that survivor and they're going to try and terrorize them.
So he's a nice guy while he's inside. And as soon as he gets out, there's only one person he's really interested in harming. So that's why he's a nice guy to everybody else. Is that what you're saying?
Because it gets him closer to his goal of being able to control the survivor again.
Are there places for families to go when they feel threatened before the violence actually takes place? But we hear, as you said, it is violence when they're pounding the wall next to your face. Clearly, that's a threat. Is there a place people can go?
Yes, absolutely. There is a place for everybody to go to where they can seek safe shelter in crisis. And we also have reciprocity throughout the state because it's possible somebody in Ishpeming doesn't feel comfortable going to their local program. And so they need to come downstate to truly escape and get away.
Now, I want to ask you what has to happen, what needs to happen for a community to protect the rights of everyone involved in a domestic dispute. But I also want to get back to that question of why we're seeing different ways of approaching this. Are we still that much of a misogynist society that we say, you know, hey, you know, she had it coming or something like that we might hear from the 1950s and I would think would be gone by now, but apparently maybe it's not. I don't know.
I've been doing this work for 20 years. This is the good news. 20 years ago, I could be in a crowded room of people from all walks of life and ask the question, do you think that domestic violence is wrong? And maybe half the hands would go up. And now I can be in a crowded room and I can ask the question, do you think domestic violence is wrong? And most of the hands will go up. That's the shift that I have seen. The thing that has not shifted, though, is what are we willing to do as communities to address the problem so that we can keep survivors safe and hold assailants accountable? That is where the interpretation starts to splinter. For example, if someone is in a quiet cul-de-sac in Saline, they hear a neighbor being assaulted. There are some people that would say, what is happening is wrong, but I have no business in calling the police. Another case in point, there could be a survivor, you know, who is working at, you know, say a hardware store, and the assailant keeps coming in and bothering her. It is possible now, though, you know, the flip of this, that the boss says, you know, you're not welcome here. You can't do this. It just really depends on who that person is, and there are different perspectives on why. I strongly encourage reporting. I strongly encourage, if you hear that happening next door, call the police. I strongly encourage letting that survivor know they are not alone, that you know what's happening and that they don't deserve it.
So when you say community, you don't mean just the police, the prosecutors, and the judicial system. You mean everybody needs to get involved.
Exactly. And I'm glad you brought it up about police, prosecutors, judges. The new police officers, when they're going out with a seasoned police officer, they're watching what that seasoned police officer is doing and how they're responding to it. If they're responding, which most of our police officers don't, oh, there they go again. She's not going to do anything. Then they're going to adopt that attitude also. Eventually, they may say, well, that's really kind of wrong. But eventually, there's a culture that's established. And fortunately, the law enforcement leadership in our community, by policy, has said domestic violence is wrong. We will hold assailants accountable. And we will call Safe House when we get a 911 call to let them know there's a survivor in the community who needs their help.
So that's key. You've got to have people who keep watch and stand up for people. Let the victims of domestic violence know that they're being cared for by others. The police have to be aware and not become callous because they see it a lot. And then it's a matter of having a safe place to go, like you've been talking about.
And then the system holding the assailant accountable so that she can continue to be safe. If he goes to jail and is just released overnight and then nothing else happens, he's like, yeah, I spent a night in jail. I can continue to do this. Whereas if they're held accountable with the judge saying what you did is wrong, with their attorney, who they deserve to have, their defense attorney, saying you did break the law and this is what's going to happen. And then when they go to jail, they are held in the jail and not released because they're Mr. Nice Guy to everybody else.
Barbara Neesmay is the executive director of Safe House Center. We've been talking about domestic violence and what can be done to prevent it in our community and your community. Thanks for coming in.
Thank you.
Stateside's executive producer is Joe Lindstroth. Contributors are Cass Adair, Melissa Benmark, Liz Dickey, and Josh Hakala. Stateside is a production of Michigan Radio, a broadcasting service of the University of Michigan. I'm Lester Graham, and for Cynthia Canty. Thanks for listening to Stateside on Michigan Radio.
Support for The Next Idea on Stateside comes from Michigan Economic Development Corporation, committed to marketing Michigan to drive job growth and investment in our communities. MichiganBusiness.org.